Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me this week for our first episode during Noirvember this year. You know, the time of year when everybody on social media especially gets very focused on film noir. And today we're talking about The Postman Always Rings Twice, the great 1946 film, based, of course, on James M. Cain's story of the same name. A film that stars Lana Turner and John Garfield, directed by Tay Garnett. And I am delighted to be joined by two guests on this episode. So first of all, let me say hello to Raquel Stetcher. Hi, Raquel.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me back.
No, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. How are things with you? How are you doing?
Good. Is this like maybe the seventh time I've been on the podcast? I feel like a regular now.
Yeah, part of the furniture, definitely. I don't know. I don't know the number, actually. The umpteenth appearance.
Yes.
By Raquel, anyway, we'll say. And Raquel and I, I'm sure, are absolutely thrilled and delighted to be joined by Sloane DeForest. Hi, Sloane.
Hi, Carl. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, because we spoke, of course, regular listeners will know, I can't remember when it was, a few months ago, about Dynamic Dames when your book was released. And at that time, you were, you know, doing all sorts of things to promote the book. I guess, you know, got a bit of perspective on all of that now. So yeah, how have things been with you? How did all the, you know, the publicity for Dynamic Dames go in the end?
It was great, especially with TCM. Turner Classic Movies had me on for a night of programming, and it was, I felt like the star of the month. It was it was a great moment in the sun for me and my Dynamic Dames.
And we're going to talk about, well, not somebody who was covered at length in the book, but at the back of the book, there's the more Dynamic Dames section. And I think Lana Turner in this film was listed there, wasn't she? So it'll be fun to talk a bit about her today.
That's right.
So Raquel and I have spoken in the past about film noir, because we spoke about Out of the Past last year, didn't we, Raquel?
Yes, my absolute favorite film noir of all time.
Oh, I love it too.
Yeah, fabulous film. So we established that Raquel's a huge noir fan. Is it the same for you, Sloane? Do you love film noir?
Absolutely. I am a noirista, I think, is the term that Eddie Muller uses. yes, I've been quite a big noir fan for quite a few many years, so I'm right on board there.
Okay, so we're going to talk about The Postman Always Rings Twice. It's a fascinating film because of what we see on screen, of course, but also because of the path this film took to the screen as well. So let's just start with some general thoughts about the film. Raquel, is this a film you're particularly fond of?
Yes, this is a perennial favorite. I don't ever not love this movie. I think it's one of those films that is great for people who love this era, who love the 1940s, who love classic films, who love black and white movies. But then it's also great for skeptics, too, people who think, oh, there's no appeal. Like, oh, classic movies don't hold any appeal to me. You can show them this. This is a great introduction to classic film. It features two amazing actors, kind of, and career-defining performances.
Yeah.
They have great chemistry. It's a character-driven story. But I have to say, too, every time I visit this story, if it's either the novel or the movie or whatever, I always feel really gross after. Feel like I'm covered in grease and I need to wash these characters off me, which I think speaks to the power of the film, how it conveys its intensity, how these characters are just so interesting and kind of vile too at the same time. So it's powerful in many ways, I think.
It is, and I'd forgotten just how powerful it actually is, because I must have seen this film, I don't know, let's say three or four times over the years, but it had been quite some time. So I remembered the broad thrust, but I'd forgotten lots of details. You know, I'd forgotten completely about Audrey Totter's character, for example. But you're right, I was really struck by the power, especially of the performances, I think. How about you, Sloane? You were saying this is one of your favourites, is that right?
Yes, it's one of my all-time favourites. I first saw it, I want to say it was almost 20 years ago, around the year 2000, when I was first getting into film noir, when I was first getting into classic film. I came across this one pretty early because it's one of the, you know, it's really one of the top most memorable entries, I think, in the classic noir era. It's also, as a Lana Turner fan, it's just, it's her greatest performance. You know, she said that it's her favorite performance she ever did. It's also my favorite performance I've ever seen her do. And she had some good ones. You know, she was very good. And a lot of her early stuff, I think, gets discarded at MGM because it was lightweight. But she was very good from an early age, I think. And she was great in the Bad and the Beautiful. You know, so, but this is just her movie. She just, she owns the movie. She owns the character. Of course, John Garfield is great too. And that's what's so great about it. These two stars together, they just, they had great chemistry. But, you know, so many great things about the movie, which I'm sure we will get into as we, go further into our discussion.
Yeah. But let's start with the origins of this story, really. So the book by James M. Cain. I think I'm right in saying we've all read the book. Now, I guess an interesting question would be like, would we recommend the book on its own merits? Or like, is it predominantly of interest because it led to this film, or it led to the film Visconti made, or the later one with Jack Nicholson? What do you think, Raquel? Would you recommend the story based on its own strengths?
I would, because the book is very short. It's like maybe 116 pages. You can read it in the time that it takes you to watch the movie. So it's very approachable. And also, it's an education in film history, in how novels are adapted to screen, because you can see the differences between what the novel contains, which, I mean, the novel is much grimier, much sexier, much more volatile than the film is. So you kind of get an education in what had to go into adapting a novel. You could get away with a lot more in a book than you could with a movie. So in comparing and contrasting, you can see basically how the production code limited what could be shown on screen, and how filmmakers had to be, you know, subtle and had to be kind of clever to get away with certain things.
Yeah, and Cain, like you say, is a very quick read, really, and he's got quite a punchy style, hasn't he? And what do you think, Slane? I think I'd struggle to imagine a situation where I'd talk to somebody about the novel, though, and not make reference to the films. But how about you?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the novel, it can be viewed through the lens. It's fascinating to view it through the lens of what we know now about the film adaptations. You know, and the fact that the novel was released in 1934, which to us film geeks, you know, means the first year of the production code.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting as well. But on its own merits, to your original question, you know, even if you haven't seen any of the films, even if you're not interested for whatever reason, I mean, if you're an insane person who's not interested in seeing any of the films, the novel is, it's really great. It's really juicy. It's really sexually explicit. I think someone who hadn't read it would be shocked today at how sexually explicit it was for 1934. And it was banned in Boston and some other places, unsurprisingly. It's very raw.
Yeah, good old Boston. We love to ban stuff here, at least in the past.
Banned in Boston is the famous saying, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, it's very lurid, isn't it, the book?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, something almost sadistic about it. So I was rereading the part where they first kiss, you know, and you got the first person narrator, and he's like, "I bit her. I sunk my teeth into her lips so deep I could feel the blood spurt into my mouth. It was running down her neck when I carried her upstairs."
You could not put that in a movie.
Well,
no,
that's exactly it, isn't it? It's not surprising, I guess, Raquel, that this is an is a story that took a while to actually get to the screen.
No, it's true. I mean, it had a long journey from when it was published in 1934 to like when it was actually made. It was filmed in like the end of 1945 and then released in 46. Like RKO took an interest in it. Now the production code had been enforced. They had to run scripts by Joseph Breen in the Hays office. So yep. RKO took a stab at it. It got turned down. Warner Brothers picked it up. They took a stab at it. It got turned down. Columbia Pictures tried several times to get it made and kept getting pushback from the Hays office. And like the Hays office was adamant about three things in particular, which was the sexual content, which is very explicit in the book, the criminal acts and how they were portrayed, and then also the dishonesty of the lawyers and representatives of the insurance companies. Yeah. So they, so MGM picked it up, and they're the ones who actually made it, but it took them several years. They tried several times to adapt it. It also was turned down, and it took James M. Cain's other novels, Mildred Pierce, and I think Mildred Pierce was released by Warner Brothers, and then Double Indemnity was released by Paramount, and that's when MGM went back and was like, hey, if they could make those films, which have somewhat similar content and similar objections, like the objections that the Hays office had, they had... You know, they could get away with Double Indemnity and Mildred Pierce. So why not Postman Always Rings Twice? And it took that precedent for them to get this made.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, isn't it? The way Hollywood standards like shifted over time and the kind of things that like motivated those shifts. What do you make of all that, Sloane? It's kind of fascinating, I think.
It is. And I find it really interesting that MGM snatched up, you know, the rights of all people, of all studios, you know, and then... As Raquel was saying, you know, once the other studios were able to release the Cain, their versions of the other Cain novels, then they could make this. And it set them up for, you know, I think that's one of the things that makes this an interesting or a unique entry in the noir canon, because it is an MGM noir. And they were not a studio known for noir. They were the opposite of gritty. They were glossy. And yet they... I find that their version sticks very close to the novel. I mean, just, you know, it's cleaned up in a lot of ways. It's sort of like Beverly Hills seedy, you know. It's like that very glossy, glamorous sort of version of these seedy people who work in a roadside hamburger stand, you know. But yet it does, they're really striving to have it be authentic and real. So it's an interesting hybrid of those things. And, if it had been made at Warner Brothers, I mean, I think a stroke of brilliance on MGM's part is that they cast, that they borrowed John Garfield from Warner Brothers. To me, that almost gives it a Warner, you know, Warner feel, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think so. There's something kind of ironic, though, isn't there? Like we said, it's kind of atypical as an MGM noir. And then apparently this was by far the most commercially successful noir of the classical period.
Yes, it was. In terms of box office dollars, made more than any.
So there's something kind of interesting about that.
And L.B. Mayer hated it, too.
Oh, is that
Even
right?
Though it was such a success, he hated the film.
Because it wasn't wholesome enough?
Probably.
It's kind of... So this hints at something then. So how does the film differ from the book? And Sloane, you've started to get into it there, but this is the kind of thing you come across when you start to read reviews of the film and so on. You see there's a bit of a difference of opinion at times. So some people, especially at the time, I think, well, even retroactively as well, does this film represent a sanitized version of the story in ways that harm it as a piece of storytelling? So I think it seems to me that's what quite a few people have said over the years. Or is it something else? Is it subtle rather than sanitized? And Raquel, where do you think the balance lies?
Well, I think, yes, it is a very polished version of the novel because the novel is a lot grittier. It's a lot greasier and in the way it's presented, way the characters are. I mean, even the depiction of Cora, she is, you know, she has dark features. She's not very good looking, where you have Lana Turner, who's this like stunning blonde, who's wearing these amazing outfits. I mean, it's totally different. It's totally polished up for Hollywood. But, there were also some things in the novel that really could not translate to film. And like, for example, that kissing scene that you had described, you couldn't put that in a film. Also, the racial tension in the book, if that had been translated to a film from the mid-1940s, because the film as it stands is very timeless, but I think that would have aged it. If you had, for example, the Nick character be Nick Papadakis, the Greek immigrant, if you had included that, that could have created some racial tension that might have made the film maybe have a bad taste in the mouth of contemporary viewers. And also, too, the character that Hume Cronyn plays is Arthur Keats. And in the novel, he's Katz. He's a Jewish lawyer who's very... he's depicted as very underhanded, and he'll do anything, and he'll use like bad techniques, probably illegal techniques, in order to get his case, won. So I think if they had put that in the film from 1946, we would have looked very poorly on that in 2019.
Yeah, and I also personally, I feel like I quite like some of the sort of tasteful things you see in classic era films that imply or suggest things. Now, it's not that I have a problem with like explicit stuff on screen, you know, quite the opposite, to be honest. But I think there's something rather clever about things like the moment in this film where we get that cut to the meat sizzling on the grill after the two main characters have met, you know. So in that sense, I think it's possible that people make too much of the sanitizing process that went on here from book to film. What do you reckon, Sloane?
I agree completely. I like the fact that it's, I mean, you can call it sanitized. It really has the rough edges polished, you know. Raquel used the word polished, and I agree. You know, there's nothing wrong with polishing up the rough edges. I mean, they had no choice, for one thing. You know, they couldn't, as we've already established, they could not include some of the more explicit content from the novel on screen. But aside from that, you know, it gives it a sheen. It gives it a, I mean, Raquel was talking about Lana Turner's character, which is huge. And of course we have to, I'm sure we'll address this more later, but you know, her Cora is so different from the novel. You know, in the novel, the way Cora is described with her long, dark hair and her dark eyes, I picture Linda Darnell more than Lana Turner, like Linda Darnell's character in Fallen Angel, the waitress. That's very sort of hard around the edges. If you've seen that movie, that's kind of more how Cora is described. So, you know, in the movie, in walks Lana Turner, a vision of blonde perfection, you know, right off the French Riviera in her little white outfit and her turban and her lipstick. Yep. So, you know, you have this heightened glamour, but at the same time, all the things that are done in the book that can't be done in the movie or shown in the movie, I think that Tay Garnett, the director, does a really good job of implying them with these lingering close-ups, you know, in the scene where Frank and Cora first meet, the famous scene, there's no words, you know, no dialogue is necessary, but you see these close-ups, you have the music, you feel the sexual tension between them. I think it's very palpable, the passionate undercurrent, you know, and sometimes I feel like that's something that's missing from contemporary movies. Actually, I think it's sexier to have that unspoken undercurrent rather than just show two people, you know, naked having sex. It's not necessarily as sexy. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. There's strength in the subtlety of that.
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything in the book that can quite compete with the impact of Cora's introduction in the film. But it's kind of interesting that it seems like there's more of a sense running through the film, but it's a romance. So I'm thinking of some of the stuff at the beach, for instance. There's a voiceover at one point where Nick says they had a week together, as we see them on the beach. We had a week together. It's the happiest I'd ever been, or something like that. Whereas in the book, I don't know, it kind of plays up the animalistic side of their pairing more, doesn't it? But like I said, we have things like that great introduction, Raquel.
Yeah, that introduction, I have to say, is one of the best film entrances of all time.
Isn't it?
Because of just, I love how they use the tube of lipstick, and then you get a shot of her shoes, and you got a shot of John Garfield's face, and then you get this full look at Lana Turner and all her glory with her white turban and her very like provocative outfit. And she's all in white, and it's interesting. She's just such a vision, and John Garfield's his character, Frank, is lusting after her at that moment. And we're almost in his point of view. We're lusting after her too, because how can you not? She's such a vision. And I think in terms of comparing this to the novel, I mean, she doesn't even look at him in the novel when he sees her for the first time, and she's very unremarkable. You can't really do that in a movie. You kind of need some sort of introduction and something to show the audience that, you know, Frank is attracted to Cora, and to have her appear like this, I think is powerful in a way that, like, you don't necessarily need that in a book, but you kind of need that in a visual form like a movie.
Yeah, one of the things I saw somewhere was how that scene is described in the script, and it just can't get anywhere close to kind of capturing the impact it would actually have when it was put on the film, which I thought was kind of interesting considering the fact, you know, the code issues we talked about and so on. What do you make sign of, like, the character of Nick? Because Raquel talked about it a few minutes ago there. So, yeah, he is quite different in the book, it seems like to me. I suppose Cecil Kellaway's interpretation of that character is rather different to the figure Kane wrote, isn't he? He's much more jovial. Mm-hmm. And Raquel's right, the ethnicity is foregrounded much more in the book and so on. What did you make of that?
Yes, and that's one thing that the film has taken heat for over the years is, I've read, you know, various critics say, oh, it's ridiculous to replace this Greek character, you know, with Nick Smith in the, you know, he's English, yeah. Or he's supposed to be, I guess, from Canada in the movie, but at any rate, you know, Cecil Kellaway is nothing like the Greek in the novel. And it's been sort of, I guess, you know, derided over the years. But it works in a strange way. I agree with Raquel. They couldn't, because their murder, you know, Cora and Frank's murder is very partly racially motivated in the book. Yeah. I mean, it's because they keep calling him this greasy Greek. You know, they can't stand him. She can't stand him. She doesn't want to have his greasy Greek baby.
Yeah.
She actually says that in the book. So that's, I agree with that decision to take out that element of it, frankly. And I think it works as well because they tweak Nick's character in the way to, you know, they really make him quite detestable in a lot of ways. Even though he's more jovial, you have all these scenes where he's falling down drunk. And then, of course, the scene where he orders Cora out of nowhere to go, you know, move away with him, sell the Twin Oaks, and she's going to spend the rest of her life taking care of his invalid sister. I mean, without even getting her opinion on it, you know, he just treats her like she's his property. So, you know, it's almost like MGM is giving us cues that, you know, don't you really want this guy knocked off?
Yeah. That's such a powerful scene. I totally agree with you. Like, that's when he becomes the villain in the story because, like, Frank and Cora are, like, the epitome of youth and beauty and virility. They're intense. They're passionate. And Nick is, like, older. He's sweet. He's mild-mannered. He just drinks a little too much. But then in that one scene, he turns quite serious, and he basically is sealing their fate. Yeah. And they have their whole lives ahead of them, and he's basically deciding their destiny. And that's when, the audience is like, okay, get rid of him, because this isn't working out.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting aspects of Cora, I think, is the way she, you know, really strives for this economic independence. You know, she doesn't want to lose the diner. Seems like she knows she can make something of it if she got the opportunity. And like we say, horrified by the prospect of having that opportunity taken away. Yeah. So I was wondering, Sloan, because like I mentioned, you listed Turner in the back of your book there under more dynamic dames. So is that what makes her a dynamic dame? Is it her desire to assert herself? Is that the kind of thing you were considering there?
It is, exactly. Because, you know, to be honest, I was on the fence about including Cora, you know, Lana Turner as Cora in The Bozeman Always Rings Twice, is even in the more dynamic dames, which is just sort of, you know, not the 50 main dynamic dames. It's sort of just like some additional ones. But at any rate, I was even on the fence about calling her that because dynamic dames are kind of women who are very much in control of their destiny. They're very strong, they're empowered, but they're aspirational. I didn't want to put a lot of, you know, cold-blooded murderesses in there. But the reason I sort of decided to go ahead and add her, well, she's a personal favorite, as I've already said, but you know, I really do think she is among the more redemptive of the screen femme fatales of that era because just as you noted, Carl, she's very much, they sort of paint her as the embodiment of the American dream in a weird way, you know, because they do want us to sympathize with her, as indicated by the fact that they dressed her famously all in white. Even her hair is much lighter platinum blonde than you've ever seen it in another movie. She's really, we're given all kinds of cues. You know, she's almost angelic. We want to side with her. And part of that is she keeps saying, I want to work hard. I want to be somebody. I want to make something of myself. I want to make something of this restaurant. You know, and that's redemptive in many ways. Also, you know, toward the end, she does genuinely seem regretful and sorry. She wants to bring another life into the world, she says, to maybe square ourselves with the life that we've taken. She's an interesting character in noir, don't you find? Mm. She's bad and she's good in a way that means you can't really label her one or the other.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a humanity to her that doesn't always come through in Femme Fatale characters. When she's pregnant, she talks about replacing the life she and Frank had taken with a new one, things like that. Right. And again, like you say, those aspirations she has are ones that are understandable. Albeit, Raquel, they have led to them doing some terrible things as well. So yeah, what's your kind of take on Cora?
Well, I think I love actually the line towards the end of the film where she says to Frank, can't you get it through your head that I'm going to amount to something? Like, that's, to me, both Cora and Frank, more so Cora, is she's like the epitome of ambition. And that's one of the reasons I love this film so much and kind of relate to it in a weird way, is that they're both kind of ambitious individuals. Frank is this very transient guy. He can't be held down. Cora is restless and she has bigger dreams for herself. She tried to become a movie star, didn't pan out. She wants to get out of her small town, but she's kind of stuck in this situation. And I think that's sort of relatable in a way. Like anyone who's grown up in a small town or in a situation where they feel stuck and they have bigger dreams than what their reality is. I mean, that's Cora. And that's, to me, even though she's doing this very despicable thing, it's also very relatable.
I would add to that real quick, if I can, that, you know, back in those days, of course, women didn't have much choice. They didn't have autonomy. Right. They couldn't, you know, especially someone like her who maybe was from a small town, a place without a lot of opportunities. What choice did she have but to get married to someone with money and let him support her? So she sort of made that choice, understandably, but then she didn't want to be stuck in it. Also understandably.
Yeah. And I think her character, it reminds me a little bit, in a strange sort of way, of something we said about Jane Greer's character in Out of the Past when we covered that episode. But only even more so in this case, I think, in the sense that you see very different sides of her at different times. You know, so sometimes it's her ambition that comes to the fore. At other times, she's very fearful. Elsewhere, she's incredibly ruthless. We see this maternal element to the character a bit later on. And then at other times, like initially, she's depicted very much as an object of desire. And I think what's so great about Lana Turner here is that I think on paper, some of those things might seem perhaps, you know, contradictory, but I never feel that when I'm watching this film. I feel this is a real character. And I think a lot of that must be down to her doing such a great job. And so you were saying you think this is her best. This is like the pinnacle of her career. Is that right?
I do. And I don't know if it was, she has written in her autobiography that she, that they were putting in her, MGM was putting her in a lot of lightweight things. And this was her first chance to really show what she could do as an actress, as a dramatic actress. So I think part of it was that. I also think part of it was being stimulated, or maybe that's the, I don't know if that's the right word. By John Garfield's presence, you know, he was very street. He was came from, we maybe we'll get more into that later, but he very much came from the streets of New York, and he had this sort of, you know, early method acting thing about him too. So I feel like he was probably a good influence on her. At any rate, I think she gives an amazing performance, and she also, she has a character arc, you know, is what I find interesting too about the character of Cora in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's in the book as well, but it's more obvious in the movie that she really, she becomes, after the murder of Nick, you know, she changes. I mean, she really becomes more tough, more cynical, more determined than ever. And yet she still has that childlike softness to her that we see, like when they first attempt to murder Nick and she says, oh, I was just a scared little girl when the lights went out. She's, you know, in the book, they describe her as a hellcat. Here, she's more like a kitten, you know, in the early scenes.
Yeah.
But she gets tougher. She gets more of that Hellcat as the story goes on. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's just a great performance, don't you think?
I do. What do you make of Turner, Raquel? Because it seems like she's an interesting figure in the sense that a lot of the time when you hear people talk about her, some of the things that happen to her off screen tend to come into the mix, don't they? But this film shows just how talented and incredible she could be, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think this is the pinnacle of her acting talents. I mean, she just delivers a really great performance. And one of the things that I love about the back and forth between her and John Garfield is that power struggle. How, like, she, you know, they kind of give to each other and then they hold back and give to each other and hold back. And she's really the source of that. She's like, oh, you know, I'm not going to talk to him for a whole week, and he's like, it's almost like she's a drug and he's addicted and he's going through withdrawal symptoms. I mean, and she does that very well. She can turn on the passion and then turn on the ice, and like Lana Turner just conveys that so well in a restrained performance. Because one of the things too about people who think that classic films are over the top or melodramatic, they think that the performances are hokey. In this, Lana Turner and John Garfield, they don't go over the top. I mean, these are really good kind of restrained performances. And I think it speaks to both actors, like how good of a job they did for this film.
Yeah. So what's the story here about those two together then? Because the story you come across when you read about the film is they maybe had something going on together for a little while. They soon realized it wouldn't work out. They didn't have any off-screen chemistry, but they had a lot of on-screen chemistry. Does that track with what you guys have heard, Sloan, perhaps?
Well, in her autobiography, Lana Turner says nothing about having an affair with John Garfield, which I think is interesting because she goes on and on about her other other liaisons. So, you know, I don't know how much smoke, you know, how much fire there is to all that smoke. I really don't know. She did say that she respected him and she liked him and they had great on-screen chemistry. So, you know, I'm not sure. Raquel, what have you heard about there being more to it? I have heard that there was more to it, but Lana's lips were sealed.
Yeah, I mean, I heard a story about him coming onto her on the set, and she was kind of repulsed, but also they might have also had an affair. So maybe he was just a little too forward and she doesn't. Maybe she didn't look back on that kindly. Maybe it was a little too much for her. That's possible. I mean, I love the word that you use, stimulating, because that is very that is very much their relationship, is kind of like stimulating each other and then holding back. But I mean, if anything, even if they didn't have an affair on set, they just together as actors had great chemistry, which is an X factor in making films. Like, that's not something you can manufacture. That's something very natural. And those two had it in this film. And that's one of the reasons why this works so well.
Yes, I completely agree. And it's something often missing from films today when, you know, if you're a big star, they often give you a kind of a nobody or a lesser star because you don't want to be outshined by them. I love this movie because it pairs these two stars and from, as I said before, from different studios. It just gives it special energy I think makes it, that's what one of the elements that really make it such a great movie.
So just quickly then, would you recommend Turner's autobiography? Because I think that's always an open question with, like, well, autobiographies in general, but classic film autobiographies, you know, are they self-serving? Are they, you know, do they whitewash things? So how does hers stack up?
Hers is pretty good. I mean, yeah, it's self-serving and yeah, it probably whitewashes things, but you get the sense, I've just always liked her. I don't know what it is, you know, she's admitted probably because she seems somehow authentic. She's able to look back and say, oh yes, it was silly in those days, but it was wonderful. And I would get dressed up and every hair would be in place and I would make an appearance at Ciro's. And, you know, she has a perspective on it that shows you that she was having fun with it and yet maybe didn't just define herself by that only, is the voice to me that I get from her, you know, from her book and also you know, that she has admitted that she had bad taste in men, which is fairly obvious.
Didn't she say once that she wanted to be married to one man and have seven children, but it was the reverse?
Yes.
She married seven men and had one child.
Right, exactly. That's Lana, but she's just such a Hollywood legend, you know, but she's a Hollywood legend, and yet she doesn't come across to me as overly pretentious or I guess self-inflated. You know, she just seems like a likable person for someone who was uneducated, taken out of Hollywood high school, you know, at age 16 to go to Hollywood. She's kind of remarkable. I mean, to go into the movies.
Okay. So let's, maybe think a bit more about Garfield then, because I think you were right what you said earlier, Sloane, that it's plain to see, I think, why MGM would have wanted to get him on loan for this part, and it does bring these associations with it. I've always really liked him as an actor. I've always thought he had a really authentic presence. What do you make of him, Raquel?
I love him in this movie and He Ran All the Way, which was his last film before he died. He's just so good. He just comes across so well. And he almost wasn't in this film. I think he enlisted to be in World War II and like in the army. And I think he had a heart condition. And so he ended up making the film anyway. But he is just like, he's so perfect for the character because he's got this presence. You can tell he's, you know, like there's something kind of not right here, but he's also pretty genuine too. And he can do the complexity of the character very well, which not every actor can. And he can also, as an actor, he can let Lana Turner shine. Like, I didn't feel like they were trying to steal the scenes from each other. They just felt like they were comfortable in the same space together, which also is not very common and kind of hard to find, especially when you have two big stars. But I love him as an actor, and He Ran All the Way. If anyone listening to this hasn't seen it yet, it's so good. It's another really great film noir. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think if overall, if people argue that this film feels a bit MGM-ified, you know, it's got this MGM sheen, but I think it's what really makes it real is those two, Turner and Garfield. You know, I think they really ground it. Yeah, Sloane, what do you make of him? Are you a fan of his?
Definitely. I agree with everything Raquel said. And also, we should point out that Gregory Peck and Joel McRae were both considered for this part. If you can imagine, I can't picture either one of them, frankly. No way. Yeah, it's all about John Garfield. I can't picture anyone but him in the role. And, you know, he was a kid from the Lower East Side in gangs. You know, he was really authentically street. And that's another thing that almost really couldn't happen today, to have a movie star of that caliber who really started out, you know, in street gangs, as a real street tough in his early days. And that's why he's authentic in that role as the drifter. And yet he's a great actor. He's polished enough to be a star. But there's an undercurrent of street to him. He lends street cred to the film, I guess you could say. And also I wanted to point out in his, like Raquel was talking about the scene, we've talked quite a bit about the scene where they first meet, but I also, you know, was noticing like his body language. It's like Raquel said, that there's almost like a challenge, like a battle of the sexes vibe between them. It starts right when they first meet. It's his body language when she's appearing there and she's just waiting for his reaction, you know, and she drops a lipstick, he picks it up, and then he pulls back and he won't give her the lipstick. He makes her come to get it, you know? So there's that push and pull, that tug of war between them throughout the whole movie, and they both pull it off so great.
And there's that other scene too, where, she's trying to light a cigarette and he just, he lights the match with a snap of his fingers. And that is just, oh my goodness. Whenever somebody does that on screen, I just get a little faint because it's just, it's quite sexy how like this lack of fear of fire, just snapping a match. And she's struggling to get the match going and he lights her cigarette and she doesn't want that. It's like that push and pull between them is just so, it's just kind of electric. It just adds something to the film.
Totally.
Yeah, I think a scene I really liked him in as well is the one where he had made the joke about Nick's death, hadn't he? And then later Cora suggests it, and he's kind of horrified. Thought he was great there.
Yeah, and that's not in the book too. I think that's interesting. They in the book it's really her idea. In the movie they give a little of the idea to him first, and I feel like they're evenly distributing the blame, you know, in a way.
That's a great point. I mean, they're equal partners in this. I mean, she's a femme fatale and he's an anti-hero, but like, yeah, they're both equal partners in the crime, which I thought, yeah, like you said, it makes it interesting, and it's also different from the book.
Yeah. And it goes back to what you said, Raquel, about, you know, almost this being kind of like a film you need to have a shower after you watch it or something, because the character, you know, because Kane's an interesting writer, because if you compare his stories to somebody like Raymond Chandler, or this story to something that Chandler wrote, I think in Chandler's books, you have like Philip Marlowe's kind of guiding you through the moral maze. You know, you have a character at the center who has a clearly defined set of values. But here it's kind of different, isn't it? So I can understand why Raquel said that earlier, Sloane, about, you know, the kind of gritty, kind of grimy feeling this film leaves you with, you know?
Yeah, Kane doesn't, he doesn't moralize. I mean, he really paints these people as kind of, you know, dirty lowlives, but he doesn't look down upon them, but he doesn't idealize them either. He's just, he presents them in a very neutral way.
So what do you make of, in terms of Frank, what do you make of the kind of religious sentiments we get from him right at the end of the film? I mean, I guess it feels like it came a bit out of nowhere in the film, but I suppose being on death row kind of concentrates your thoughts, whatever it might be. So yeah, what did you think, Raquel?
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought of that. But yeah, that whole scene where he's visited by the priest and then he, you know, says to send up a prayer for himself, and he hopes that he'll end up in the same place as Cora. I thought that was interesting. And like you said, you know, it's something typical when you're at the end of your life and you're about to be hung for a crime that maybe you start to think about, you know, the greater, maybe in a greater sense of what you did and what's ahead and like what's, you know, what happens after death and things like that. So yeah, I mean, in the book, it's like the last page. I mean, it's not very much of it in there. And in the film, it's very short, but I guess it makes sense for a situation.
Yeah. More broadly, I guess, Sloane, what did you make of the shift into like courtroom drama? Cause I suppose there are scenes like in the second half of the film where Frank and Cora are a bit more passive. But it's also a lot of fun to see like Hume Cronin and Leon Ames take center stage, isn't it? So do you think those sequences stand up to the first half of the film?
I do. It's strange, this film, you know, this kind of trajectory is unusual. I mean, like if you were to compare it to Double Indemnity, for one thing, they didn't do it for the money. I mean, they really didn't even know about the insurance policy in Postman, you know, and also all that legalese and all that. I think it strains credulity at some point, you know, a little bit because they're in the courtroom, all this legal mumbo jumbo, Your Honor, we waive this and we waive that, and suddenly, boom, she's free. I mean, it can happen that way, probably, but it just seems a little, it seems a little unlikely. But I think that that's done intentionally, because it's sort of like, you know, that it really harkens back to the theme, and this touches on what you were just talking about as well with his redemption in the end, his religious, you know, talk about God. I mean, the whole film is about destiny, isn't it? I mean, that's even the title is directly alludes to, you know, fate. You can't escape your fate. The postman always rings twice. Even if you don't hear him the first time, he's going to come the second time. So that may be kind of a fuzzy metaphor for some people today, when we don't even, you know, the postman doesn't ring at all. But but I mean, that's what it means. And that's a theme throughout the whole thing, is like, these people aren't tripped up by the law. They're tripped up by themselves, by their own actions that they can't escape, you know. I don't know if that really answers your question about the courtroom stuff. But
I think it does, because that's what I was thinking, is that it adds in a funny sort of way to the sense of fatalism, that they're not in control anymore. So I like the courtroom stuff, I think. How about you, Raquel? What do you think?
I find that all of those scenes get a little convoluted, and anytime I watch that, I kind of get a little confused, and maybe I lose interest a little bit. I think, I don't know why, but sometimes I have to rewind and be like, okay, exactly what happened in that scene? But one thing I thought was super interesting to compare the book with the movie is the character of the district attorney played by Leon Ames, Kyle Sackett. In the movie, they actually involve him more. He stops by Twin Oaks. He kind of knows what's going on, and he actually follows them in their second murder attempt and catches them in the act, sort of, like, after the fact. But I thought that was interesting, especially when the studios had so much difficulty getting this to screen, and one of the objections being the fact that lawyers were being portrayed as duplicitous characters. They didn't feel that was correct for this movie. He's almost like a weird guardian angel. He's hovering over them, and in a way he's depicted as like, okay, you can't really escape the law. The law is always there watching, kind of thing. So I thought that was an interesting thing. And maybe to solve that production code issue is to kind of beef up his character a little bit.
Okay, at this point, I'll call a timeout and I'll say Kathy Glinsky, who listens, I think, who I've had on the podcast a couple of times, she's a defense attorney, and we talked about 12 Angry Men and Anatomy of a Murder. So, Kathy, if you're listening, I'd love to hear what you have to say about the legal accuracy or otherwise of this film. So let us know. All right, maybe this is a bit broader then. So this film, as an example of film noir, so like Raquel's already said, this might be a really good one to show skeptics and so on. We've talked about it being kind of atypical as an MGM film noir. How else does it kind of conform to expectations or otherwise? I guess one of the interesting things is it's something like a film like Out of the Past that isn't as focused on the city. You know, we're at this kind of out-of-town diner for the most part, aren't we? So I thought that was kind of interesting, Raquel.
Can I just say, I think the location is one of the greatest strengths of the story, Twin Oaks. And I've always been fascinated with rest stops, or like, this is like a roadside diner. This is where you stop to refuel your body, refuel your car, you know, but you're not meant to be there for a long time. But the people who work there, or in this case, live and work there, this is their permanent home. And it's such a temporary place. There's no sense of community because everyone is, even if you have regulars, they're only there for a short time. So it's very isolating. And I think that adds to the tension and drama of the story so well. And it, both the book and the film incorporate the Twin Oaks. You know, like, Cora has dreams of making it into something. She kind of turns it into a beer garden. There's that whole thing with the sign, it falling down and getting replaced with a neon sign. And then it electrocutes the cat because the wiring is off. That was really interesting. And then also, because of where they are, location wise, there's the Santa Ana winds, and that also kind of feeds into the, intensity and the passion of what's going on, is these destructive winds that flow through the area. So I think in terms of a sense of place, this is like spot on.
Yeah, that's interesting though, isn't it? Because is it 81, the next version with Nicholson?
Yes.
That one really plays up the kind of Depression era setting, doesn't it? Visconti's adaptation is much more kind of realistic, I guess. This one's got the MGM kind of sheen, and I guess it's slightly more, I don't know what the word is. I was going to say neutral. I don't think that's quite right.
Well, it's not a greasy diner. She's dressed all in white. She's not going to get any burger grease on her outfit. it's a very cleaned up and very pretty version of Twin Oaks.
Yeah, because I'm not sure we needed to see a lot of period detail to make this story work. And I think this story works better than the 1980s adaptation. What's your take, Sloane?
Actually, I have refrained from watching the 81. I can't seem to bring myself to do it because I love the 46 version so much. I'm going to have to see it one of these days. So I can't compare. But to what Raquel was saying about the location, I definitely agree. I think it would be hard. Well, it'd be hard in a lot of ways to really match this movie. With the locations, I feel like they did a good job, MGM, because, you know, at that point, they wanted to film everything on the back lot. They really didn't do a lot of location shooting. Yet they did go to Norwalk, California, outside of Los Angeles. They went to Laguna Beach to shoot the beach scenes. So it carves out this distinct kind of, you know, feel. The fact that they're, like Raquel said, they're isolated in just this Twin Oaks, middle of nowhere kind of come and go roadside place. And yet there's wide open spaces, the beach, the cliffs, you know, when they're in the car through the mountains, and they're, it feels wide open and yet trapped in a weird way. Like they're trapped there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Have you seen the 81 version, Raquel? What did you make of it?
The other night I had a double feature where I rented both films and I watched them back to back. And I do not recommend the 81 version because it does try to capture some of what was left out of the 46 version that's in the book. Like, for example, they make Nick Papadakis. They include that is ethnicity. That's part of the plot. I don't think that Jack Nicholson and Jessica Lange have the same chemistry that Lana Turner and John Garfield have. That's lacking. It's a lot grittier. It is set in the Great Depression, which the book is set in there too. It's a lot, it's a lot, dustier, grimier. And they cut off the end. Like, you don't get the same ending as you do in the book and the 46 version, which is incredibly frustrating because when the credits started to roll, I was like, that's it. What happened? So yeah, if you love the 46 version and, you're skeptical about the 81 version, stay that way or watch it and then wash it from your mind and go back to the original.
Well, yeah, because I've seen it, but it's been a long time. So what I mainly remember is it's much more sexually explicit.
Oh, yes.
Famous sex scene. Does it keep the voiceover? I can't quite remember. I think it might not.
It doesn't, no.
Right, so this film obviously has the classic noir voiceover, and I'm kind of a sucker for that kind of storytelling device. I like the fact where granted some access to Frank's thoughts about things like his obsession for Cora. But I don't know, I guess the counter argument would be that maybe that's a bit, you know, maybe it's spoon feeding the audience. What do you think, Sloane?
Oh no, I love the voiceover. I mean, I'm with you on that. It gives it that noir feel, you know? That's one of the tropes, I guess you could say, of film noir is to have the voiceover narration. And also it gets some of that Kane prose in there, you know, from the book. It works because it gives you a perspective that you wouldn't get from this drifter. Otherwise, it's like a shortcut, I guess, to get some of his perspective on it. And like, yeah, it does spoon feed the audience, but I like what I'm being spoon fed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In this case.
Yeah. I think the fact also, it's interesting that it's relayed to you with this kind of after the fact perspective, which adds an interesting element to the mix. We later find out he's talking to the priest. Mm-hmm. And I think that just kind of keys you into the fact that something's going to go wrong here. It just adds, I think, Raquel, to the sense of like fatalism we talked about in a story like this in a way that's kind of, yeah, I like it too. I think it's kind of intoxicating almost.
Yeah, and it's very film noir, just like setting it up as a big flashback, you know. And I like what you had to say, Sloane, about having the voiceover be kind of representative of the book too. Like he's telling you his story in the movie like he is in the book. And I think it works really well.
Okay. So I guess the big question is, and we've kind of said this at the outset, I think, but it's like, how highly does this rate in the noir kind of canon? So yeah, you wouldn't have any hesitation, Sloane, with listing this alongside things like Double Indemnity or Out of the Past or whatever it may be when somebody comes to you for a list of great film noirs, no?
No, I'd call it certainly top five in anyone's top five could go easily in there.
I agree. It's definitely if you're going to make a list of the top film noir and this isn't on it, there's something wrong with your list.
Yeah, I think people need to check this out if they haven't seen it, of course. One of the things I thought was interesting, just before we do wrap up, I thought it was quite striking that the book itself is displayed on the on-screen credits. I thought that was kind of fun. And it seems like the notoriety of the book was exploited quite a lot in the film's promotion. So I'm seeing like taglines like, their love was a flame that destroyed and stuff that really hypes it up. So it's interesting it had this kind of double thing where it goes through this process of making it acceptable for the screen. And then all the promos and things are talking about how scandalous it is and so on. But yeah, I don't know if either of you have seen like the trailers or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a good point. I think I was going to bring that up too. You know, the film, the marketing for the film is very much, they market it almost as a woman's picture, as a romantic drama. you know, which was very common for the time because women's films were huge in this era still, especially with the men off to war in this specific era. And it is a woman's picture in some ways. I mean, Lana Turner is top billed. She's the star, you know, no question about it. So they play up the romance and the illicit romance. You know, they may sanitize it, but they still play it up, like you said.
So before we go, do either of you have anything else you wanted to point out about this film before we start to wrap up? Raquel, how about you?
I have to say, I really like the theme of cats in the story overall. This is something that, Sloan, you had mentioned earlier. I was trying to remember, like, the character that Audrey Totter plays, Madge, who she's basically an expert on taking care of, like, big cats and using them in films and things like that. And then there's also that scene with the cat going up the ladder and getting electrocuted. And that's a really great use of, like, I mean, this is something that pops up in film noir a lot, is that you can plan for something, but you can't plan for the unexpected. So a lot of crimes are thwarted by something that goes wrong. And in this case, it's the cat who gets electrocuted, and Cora can't go through with the actual plan. She can only do it halfway. So I think the theme of cats is, you know, is subtle, but is interesting. And it's more prominent in the book, because in the book, when Cora finds out that Frank has had an affair with Madge, she leaves him, like a baby jaguar or something. She leaves him with a wild cat, which they have in their home, which they don't have in the film, but I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Sloane, did you have anything else you wanted to bring up before we go?
I did want to mention the George Bassman score, because it's kind of huge. It really punctuates the drama here. I mean, you know, every time they suggest a murder or they anything unseemly, dun, 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 it's almost like Dragnet, you know? Very, very red flag with the score, don't you think?
I do. All right, both. Well, thanks very much for joining me today. It's been a lot of fun, at least for me. So, before we go, where can people find you guys online? Raquel, where are you online?
Well, I talk about classic movies on my blog, outofthepastblog.com, which everyone's welcome to come visit. I also have a YouTube channel that goes with it, and I am on Twitter a lot, which is just at Raquel Stetcher, my name. And I'm also on Instagram at Kel Movies, and I just love to talk about movies, and I love to hear from people.
Thanks, Raquel. So, Sloane, I'm right in thinking you're slightly harder to find as an individual on social media, but the book is quite easy to find. Is that correct?
I'm easy to find online. Just SloaneDeForest.com. You can Google my website, comes up. So, yeah, everything you need to contact me or about me is on my website, SloaneDeForest.com. Dynamic Dames book is on Instagram, and the book Dynamic Dames is available everywhere, anywhere you want to buy it.
And it's a great book.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's all for today, listeners. You can find the Movie Palace in all the usual places online, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. For Noirvember, if all goes to plan, our next episode will be looking at Detour. So if you haven't seen Detour, you've got a couple of weeks to go and check it out before the episode comes. But that's it for this episode. I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace. If you enjoyed this episode of the Movie Palace and you'd like to support the podcast financially, you can buy me a cup of coffee via the Ko-fi website. Go to ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. That's ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. CarlSweeney. Thank you.